Bored with Friends Spotlight. Stellar Armada.
I mean, I'm not allowed to tell that story because Zach wants to stay on topic.
Stay on topic.
All right, well, we got a little off topic.
Again, 40%.
I'm lazy and I'm a mooch. What I do?
This is not that kind of podcast.
Zach here. So this Spotlight episode, we got to interview Jerison Baines. He's the designer behind the Stellar Armada game. This is a pretty cool game that's up currently on Kickstarter, and all you have to do to get it is back $1. So Jerison takes us through the ins and outs of, you know, his inspiration for the game, the hurdles that he's had in the development, and what he may go on to do next, you know, in the future.
Talk about, you know, how it was developed. I found the story the most interesting because, you know, you saw that old, that $1 board game that was more of a joke. So, you know, if that's what inspired you, from what I understand.
Yeah.
If I'm right.
Well, I mean, it was kind of two things going on simultaneously, right? One is that I'd wanted to get into Starfire for a long time. I don't know if you guys have ever read David Weber's books, Honor Harrington, anything like that.
No, I haven't read any of that.
So they were New York Times bestsellers. So, you know, very, very popular books.
Okay.
Well, David Weber got his start actually as a Hex Encounter Wargamer. And he was,
really?
If you go back to many of the old instructions for Starfire, he's actually listed in the credits for various games and invented, I guess, the third edition of the game. So the problem is that when I, I had really enjoyed his books as an author, and it was like, oh, hey, you know, this is a board game that inspired his books. I'd, you know, love to understand it. And I went and tried to get a copy of Starfire. I did get a copy of Starfire, the current Starfire, back in 2006, I think it was. And it was just impenetrable. I mean, I could not. I get these books. I've never done this stuff before. And I'm looking through these books. There's like hundreds of rules. And I'm not even understanding. I'm like, am I supposed to start at the beginning and just read one after another? And I'm like, this is making no sense whatsoever. After a lot of effort, I eventually figured out how to get two ships to fight each other, right? Using the rules, ignoring the entire Empire game and all that. Because it's more than just, you know, starship combat. There's also, you know, you're supposed to set up based on there being a meta empire that, you know, your ship, you know, builds ships and then you send them to different star systems and meet up and all that, right? Very, very, very massive game.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. And I figured out how to bring it down to just the, you know, two starships fighting. Well, if you've ever played a war game before, you know that it's not any fun in most cases to have symmetrical warfare. It doesn't work, right? Because all you do is you both do the exact same moves, whatever the optimal strategy is for the moment, blast each other to bits, and you're pretty much entirely beholden to the will of the dice, as it were, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is not fun at all. So it went on my shelf. I forgot about it for years and years and years. Eventually got into board gaming, you know, through Kickstarter and all that. The game that started out was a game called Province. You guys familiar with that? It was a $5 board game.
I haven't heard of that one either.
Yeah, it came out about the same time that Tiny Epic Kingdoms came out.
Oh, all right.
Yeah,
that one I know.
At the same time. Well, I hope so. I got a whole bunch of Tiny Epic games back here.
Walt's not a fan of the Tiny Epic series, but I like them a lot. So,
yeah, I think they're just fantastic. And Scott Olem's work is a huge inspiration to me, right? How he tries to reduce components, down to the absolute minimum. To me, it typifies the saying, you know, you're done when you can't take anything more away, right? So, anyway, Province is a tiny Euro game, you know, made on chipboard. You got a board about, I think it was maybe 2.5 inches square, and then there was a board you punched out with tokens. Actually, ended up with a lot of components, as the case might be, and it was kind of cool, right? I never played a Euro game before. Obviously, Catan had become hugely popular, and I had friends trying to get me into Catan, but the time investment in games just wasn't working for me. So this province thing came along. I'm like, hey, this is cool. And it plays in a half hour or less. So I thought that was really neat and got into board gaming. But I always kind of wanted to get back to that Starfire. I'm like, okay, I've been board gaming now. Could I get back to Starfire? I tried a couple times, didn't work. And then eventually, what I'd been unable to do, because I figured if I went back to the original that was produced in 1979, hey, you know, that would, people in 1979 got that just fine, and it was considered a micro game at the time, just, you know, instructions, a hex board, and some counters packed into a Ziploc bag. That would probably go really well. But acquiring a copy of that is really hard. Right, those were not treated well back in the day. And for whatever reason at the time, the Starfire website, they wouldn't republish it. Well, I checked in, I think it was earlier this year or late last year, and I realized that they finally republished the original rules along with a few other rule sets. I could purchase them online for a reasonable cost and print it out and play it. And, of course, I still had a Starfire set, so all I really needed was the rules. Though, I mean, it's Hex Encounter. It's not that hard to print something out, right?
All you need is a marker and some paper.
Yeah, right? and so I play this game, and what was really interesting to me that I didn't realize was missing from the original, besides the asymmetrical scenarios, which is, you know, critical to that type of wargaming, was the scenarios themselves, right? Because the more modern Starfire was all about you were supposed to build your empire and that, you know, capture territories or defend territories, which is how scenarios would get set up, right? You would do that through your development of your empire. In old Starfire, that didn't exist, right? It was just a scenario set up. You jump in from this jump point. Your enemy would be, you know, protecting these resources, whatever it might be, right? And, you know, it was already set up. And then there's a story that wove through it. And it just grabbed me right away. I'm like, oh, I feel like I'm in this universe that I'm playing this, these starships that I'm actually fighting this battle. And these, their characters and, you know, real things are happening. Now I can see where the books that Dave Weber, wrote came from and how this all went from one thing to another. And that was really cool. Right. Being a sort of really interested in board games, started doing the fledgling designer thing, tried to modernize Starfire, because as much as I thought this was really cool, it's the 21st century. I can't deal with pen and paper because the way that ship management worked in the original Starfire is that ship systems were listed out in a string of letters. So it was like, you know, different letters for different systems. And as you take damage, right, you just cross out the system left to right. And that's how your ship would take damage, which was kind of neat, but also very limiting, right? It made a lot of sense in 1979 when pen and paper, we all did that, right? No problem there. And our writing skills were fantastic. This being 2016, my writing skills have atrophied so badly that it took me about a half hour to an hour just to write out the ships. And it's like a handful of ships. It's like, okay, this is ridiculous, right? So I'm like, could I make this into player mats? Could I make it more visual? Could I, you know, describe things? I set myself the goal of not changing the rules until absolutely necessary. And I kind of got to the point where it was about where I needed to change the rules to really make the thing work in that fashion. Because the rules were written in a way that they didn't think about, you know, the visual aspect. And so there were cases where, this system might use this many hull points in this case, but that many hull points in that case. So if I was trying to make tokens to represent them, right, I'd have to make, like, different size tokens depending on the type of ship and blah, 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 right? At the same time, right, the obligatory $1 pledge level game hit. So I'm sitting there here thinking through these things, trying to solve this problem. And this guy, he's sitting there going, hey, you know, I've been looking at this little thank you pledge level that exists in the in every Kickstarter ever. You know, you just spend a dollar and they say thank you, right?
It always amazes me when people actually pick that. I mean, it's nice because they're giving money to the publisher to try and, you know, make it happen. But it just amazes me. I'm like, it seems like it's generous, but at the same time, it's like it feels stingy to just give them a dollar, you know? Mm-hmm. It just feels weird to me that exists.
I can tell you how it's typically used, right? One would think it's altruistic that you use the $1 pledge level to, throw them a dollar and say, hey, good job. Keep up the good work. In practice, most people use it to, I'm going to pledge a dollar, and then I'm going to use it as a platform to make comments or whatnot, right? The updates or right. So there's some amount of economic value that they're getting out of that dollar, even if they don't get the product. Right. And if you think about it today in today's world, right, we can manufacture just about anything. We can, print just about anything. I mean, print and play blows my mind by itself. Right. Mm-hmm. Which, I can make at home components that are, they're dang near as good as what you could have professionally printed, right? I have a black and white printer, so, this card is, black and white, but I made it myself, right? It's just two index cards that I glued together, cut it out, and took a cornering tool to it, and it's pretty darn good, right? Mm-hmm. And then you get into the 3D models, right? Like, there was a project I backed where it had miniatures, and they sent out files for you to print the miniatures yourself on a 3D printer. And it's just like, oh yeah, I guess that's a thing, huh?
I drool over the thought of having a 3D printer.
Yeah, well, as a lover of minis, I do too.
My local
too expensive.
Yeah, my local library has a 3D printer.
A couple of them do around here too. My mother's a librarian, and she's always boasting that she's going to get one and set up a lab. And I think our local library in Coventry has it. I saw it out of the corner of my eye when we brought the kids there, and I was like, one of these days I'm going to get to play with that.
Why don't I know these things? I want to abuse a 3D printer.
It's in the Coventry Library.
Endless possibilities now. Oh, my God.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're in a world where experience is everything, right? It's all about the experience you provide. The actual materials, the build itself, the product, yeah, it's important, but it's not as important as it once was, right? At this point, I'd rather have a digital music file or movie file than I would a physical disc, right? Physical disc is just taking up space. It doesn't help me at all. I feel as much, if not more, of an attachment to the digital file than I do the physical one. So in that sort of economy, right, we've identified rightly that what it was that we liked all along was the experience, and that it's the experience we're after. So the $1 pledge level is, I can get some sort of piece of this experience by giving a dollar, which, is probably what that the actual economic value of that particular experience is.
So when you saw that Kickstarter, that the obligatory $1 pledge level game, which I saw too, and I thought it was very clever. It was very funny, but it really wasn't a game. Is that what made you start to think, like, okay, I could turn Stellar Armada into this and see if I could do a $1 game? Is that really what the jumping off point was?
Yeah, kind of. It was. So what happened is I looked at this, and at first I thought, right, he says, I put my game designer skills to the challenge. Can I make a $1 board game? Challenge accepted, right? Mm-hmm. He says, and I'm sitting there like, hey, this sounds awesome, right? I'm looking at this game, and I'm trying to get, okay, how's this a game, right? And it takes me a little bit to actually percolate in that this is not a game, this is just a joke, right? He's absolutely replicated the experience, quote unquote, of a $1 pledge level. You put your dollar in, you take a card, it says thank you. Okay, great, right? But it's not a game. And in fact, I guess he tried to submit it to Board Game Geek, and they said, well, we're not going to carry this because it's not a game.
Yeah.
there's no win or loss condition. And I'm looking at this, and I was just disappointed, right? I'm like, well, why couldn't you make a game for a dollar, right? Materials these days are cheap enough if you can do it in sufficient bulk or, work the materials right and whatnot. And so I kind of set myself to the task of, hey, could I make a $1 game, right? So I've got kind of got these two things going in parallel. What would it, would it be possible to make a $1 game? And, how can I make Starfire Modern Game? And, you know, that's it's kind of how my hobbies go, right? I'm figuring I'm going to transition from one hobby to the next. Instead, they ended up melding in a weird way, right? So first I'm shopping components and, you know, trying to figure out if I had a printer do this, what would that cost for a printer to do that? And I had to do, it was difficult because I do a lot of stuff online, because just walking into a printer and saying, hey, what could you print? You know, it would be $100, and they'd be like, well, what do you want to print, right? And so that's not going to be the most productive conversation. So, you know, I'm looking through online quotes for different things, and okay, well, I could do a postcard, but a postcard won't work because it's the wrong shape. What if, you know, we had the same sort of full-color print in a more of a letter shape? Would that make a good game board? You know, I was thinking at the time, well, if I printed a sheet of chipboard, figure out how many units I needed to make a die cut it affordable. Because I think a die for cutting is somewhere between $500 and $1,000, and you can use it, you know, 10,000-20,000 times, which isn't bad. Hmm.
I guess you get your money's worth out of that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And you know, another inspiration was if you've seen Star Command, what do you call them? Wildfly or whatever he calls his games. So these are classic Hex Encounter games. Pocket Option Games is what he calls his company. Carrier Commander is the game I'm thinking of. And he's been doing this for really cheap now, but it works, right? He's able to do it. He's able to do it very affordably. So, you know, that's encouraging me to be able to do it. So I'm shopping these components. I have no idea what type of game I want to make. And one day I'm just sitting there thinking about it, and it hits me. What if we took away the maneuvering of Hex Encounter games, right, and focused on just the combat? And what if it was like, you know, systems exposed rather than, you know, taking down systems one at a time like you have in Starfire? And this idea, it got in my head. So I ran downstairs, grabbed an index card, started sketching something out, you know, channeling Star Trek here. Okay, I need shields, I need energy weapons, you know, some sort of missile, I need a reactor, right? And I started thinking about how these components are going to interact, right, and what they would do in the game, because these are all very standard things you find in sci-fi ships. And it takes me maybe 20 minutes to kind of come up with the initial concept, and I grab my oldest son. I'm like, hey, you want to play a game with me? and he's got a very good strategic mind. He really likes chess, and he usually kicks my butt at Starfire. he's got a good mind for this, right? So he sits down with me, and we start cycling on this, trying to tune it to functioning rules. You know, how will this work? How will that work? You know, do I have enough missiles? Do I have too many missiles? You know. One of the things we eventually figured out was that in case of missiles, because they're so powerful, we had to nerf them a couple times, first in reducing the number of missiles that they had. But then again, we figured out that reducing the number of missile launchers was a good approach. So we went rounds and rounds on this, tuning it, and the result was a Stellar Armada game that you see. It was actually the funny thing. It's called Star Cruiser at the time, which seemed like a free enough name. But when I started shopping around the name to people I knew, they didn't really glom onto it very well. They're like, yeah, that's an okay name. So started thinking about, you know, putting together different words and came up with a bunch of them. And Stellar Armada came out as the best-liked name.
It rolls off. It's a cool-sounding name.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was cool about it is that, you know, started thinking about, okay, well, this gaming system seems to work really well. So, you know, what if I was to create more types of ships, right? It's in this initial game I created, it was just this exactly symmetrical ships fighting each other, right? So it was all about the individual decisions you make during gameplay to try and defeat your opponent, how you fight your ship, as it would be. If I were to make a sequel, I think what would be really cool is to have a deck of these cards where each card would be a different type of ship with a different set of weapons and, you know, abilities. And, you know, you deploy fleets of these, and, And yeah, that would be really neat, right? Forget the hex encounter. Nobody cares about the hex encounter, right? Let's just blow each other away, right?
I was going to say the name, you know, Armada just implies that there's going to be a lot of ships. So it just, you know, you get your fleet of ships, and that sounds cool. If there's different designs, like some ships have more, you know, more weapons but less shielding, and you know, faster ships. Although you said maneuvering is not part of it. Maybe there could be some sort of speed mechanic, though, that comes up in a different way. Now, just go into the actual gameplay. Like, what did you design here? Because how would a scenario go in Stellar Armada?
Right. So first off, let me do say, right, you mentioned there's no maneuvering, but there could be a speed mechanic. Well, there is sort of something like that. The engines here. If you spend action points on that, then you basically get evasive maneuvers. What that does, that adjusts the probability on the opponent's die.
Oh, right? Okay.
So, if you spend no power on your engines, if he rolls a 2, you're hit. 2 or higher. That's it, right? So you have no defense. You're a sitting duck. But if you spend 3 points on engines, he has to roll a 5 or a 6 to hit you, right? So it's all about how many engines you power up to what you change the probabilities to. Now, the way this works as a game is the nougaty center of the ship here is the reactor. Mm-hmm. And the reactor gives you 6 action points, right? Because this is your source of action points. So every undamaged reactor is 1 point you can take during your turn. Systems that you can spend it on are the masers down below, which are an energy weapon, which will do 2 points of damage if they hit, right? Each one will do 2 points of damage. Missiles up top, you know, above the reactor, they do sort of the same thing. There's 2 launchers and 1 inert piece of armor. The armor is, you know, when we took away the 3rd launcher, we needed it balanced all the way around. So we added the armor to make sure there were 3 points of damage there. And then this top line here is how many missiles you have left, right? So you start with 10 and work your way down. And then you've got the repair systems here next to the reactor. The repair systems allow you each point each action point you spend on repair allows you to repair any system except for your reactor. You don't need to use it on your shields because those can be recharged without using the repair. So in theory, you could recharge your shields and do 3 repairs to your ship. And then over here, your shields, that's 5 points. They basically soak up damage, right? And that's their job in life. So gameplay-wise, right, it's all about you decide which systems you want to activate when, and with the limited energy or action points you have to spend, right? And as your ship takes damage, you have to make some very difficult decisions, right? Do I power my engines or do I take a risk and fire more weapons in the hope that I'll do more damage to him before he does damage to me, right? The best defense is a good offense. Similarly, right, so in the latest rules, the damage doesn't bleed through the shields, so I might be trying to put a couple of points of shield into shields every turn just so that to keep his missiles off of me, right? He's not going to want to fire missiles if I've got, like, 1 or 2 points in the shields. He's going to try and fire masers to get through it, which will do less damage if they make it through to the ship itself. The reactor can't be damaged until the surrounding systems have been damaged, right? So the layout on the card is not accidental. The reactor's been put inside these 4 systems to represent that they are effectively sidewalls that protect the reactor, right?
But it's cool because you got it laid out just like a ship, basically. Exactly. You know, looking at it, it looks like the side view of like the Enterprise. If you were watching Next Generation, they have that in the engine room. You know, they got the big blueprint version of the Enterprise, so you can see everything and all the systems. So I definitely see what you're going for there. Exactly. Pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly that. Of course, once you blow away a system, right, you've got access to the reactor, and you know if you start taking away if you start doing damage to your opponent's reactor, it's going to snowball. It's going to start snowballing fast, right? You can do you can make some good decisions. You can try and use your limited energy effectively, but you know, you lose 2 points of damage on your reactor. Now you can only do 4 action points per turn. If he's still got 6, well, he's got a clear advantage. that was not. Now it's interesting because reviewers often point out that it gets snowbally toward the end, and they're surprised when I say, "Yeah, that's an intentional design decision, right?" Usually, snowballing is considered really bad in games. The problem is that if you've ever played a war game like Starfire or really any war game ever. The problem with them is that you may have already lost, but you haven't lost, right? So you spend a whole lot of time with this pretense that somehow you're going to come back when you're not, right? You're already dead. You're walking dead. And it can get even more annoying when you start chasing each other around the board, right? So, I want to take your ship out. Well, I have enough movement points to where I can keep ahead of you, and now we're, playing the game of trying to corner you. It's sort of like a the end game in chess sometimes when you get down to those last few pieces.
That's exactly what I was saying. Yeah. When you're just chasing each other, moving. It's like, just end me. Just end me now.
You could forfeit at any time, man.
Exactly, right? And that's not fun. It's not fun. So it's like, well, if you start taking damage to your reactor, you get a little bit of chance to do something about it. But it's going to be game over very quickly, and that's okay, right? Because what I want people to think is one more game, not, oh man, that drug on forever.
Yeah. Some games can overstay their welcome. So now are you able to, like, say I'm attacking you, are you able to target certain systems, or does the defender decide what gets damaged, or is there an order that gets damaged that it happens in?
Yeah. So what happens is once you've taken down their shields, the attacker calls out which system they're firing against.
Okay, that's what I want to know.
Yep.
I like that better because, it sounds like I'm telling my gunner, okay, target their engines or target their missile launchers.
Right.
It's like you're in charge of the ship, which I like.
It's like
you could almost expand this,
like,
actually.
Starter, right?
Yeah, exactly. You could almost expand this to have like a crew and, so certain people are doing certain things, almost like what's that game that's coming out? That submarine game. I just heard about it.
Yes.
We talked about it previously. But basically, different people are different. Captain Sonar, that's the name of the game. Different people are different crew members of the submarine, and you're shouting orders, and one person is the captain and saying, okay, we're going to go north. Now we're going to go south. And, somebody else is listening in and trying to figure out where the other team is. This sounds like a very... Like, it could expand into something like that at some point, but just the simplified aspect of it and how quick the game sounds like it's going to play, I really like the idea of this. This is something that you can carry in your pocket, take to work, play on a break and be done with it, which is really cool.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, this tuck box here is it's a 36-card tuck box, so it's the height and width of a deck of cards, but the depth is only 2/3 the size of a deck of cards. So
nice.
It's very, 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 very portable. And if you've got the $1 version, it's even more portable. It's just a baggie. Two cards and some pieces, right? You'll have to figure out.
You could almost call that the retro baggie, because it goes back to your roots with the Starfire game. So,
right.
So I have a question for you. When designing this game, what took precedent more than anything? Was it building a game that was as cheap as possible, like for a dollar? Was it you were trying to keep the game at that dollar mark, or were you just trying to set out to make a more simplified version of Starfire? Where was the balance there? Was it leaning more towards the $1 or more towards the Starfire?
So I think that the critical overriding balance in any of this is making a good game, right? That's the first thing that has to happen. So then it was a matter of the constraints interacting. Right. You guys have all seen George Lucas's prequels, right?
I don't know what you're talking about. I've never heard of things.
Is this like the XKCD comic where they're like, Matrix was such a good movie, it's too bad there weren't any sequels, and the guy comes up from behind and he's like, oh, there were sequels, and they look at him, and you get the sense that they bury him off, kill him and bury him, and they're like, Matrix is such a good movie, it's too bad there weren't any sequels, right?
Yeah, it's just like I can't wait for a fourth Indiana Jones,
Hey, don't joke about that. I was at Universal Studios at one point, and the action show for the Indiana Jones, and
I'm like, man,
weren't they going to come out with a new Indiana Jones movie? I wonder when that's coming out. And about a minute and a half later, I'm like, oh, Crystal Skull. It just, like, totally, it was that bad. I could not even remember that it existed. So anyway, getting back to the point I was going to make is the reason why the prequels were not as good as the first movies is George Lucas spent all of his time, he didn't want to make any more Star Wars movies, not so much his excuse of I wanted better technology. I mean, the original movies look pretty damn good, right?
They still hold up in my opinion.
Yeah, and you can't say that the new movies look that much better. In many ways, they look worse, right? No, that excuse didn't hold water. What it really was is that he was trying to get out from under what he perceived as the thumb of the studios, right? The studios were imposing constraints on him. And so he got into a situation where he had no constraints imposed on him. And the end result is exactly what you see. If you find a really hardcore Star Wars fan and get them to take you through the first three movies, there are so many things they can point out to you happening in the background. There's so much vibrancy and neat things. But at the end of the day, you're looking at it, this is like, this is a terrible movie, right? This is no fun. I don't like this. Even I don't care how much Star Wars, knick-knack, whatever is going on in the background. The movie itself is terrible, right? And so what was going on here is I was using those constraints to try and develop a good game, right? And that was a challenge. So in many ways, I guess you could say that the $1 aspect was an overriding constraint, but I saw it more as just the boundaries in which I had to work, right? And it was always an option to go above those boundaries if necessary. Why go outside your boundaries when the whole goal is to try and stay inside them? Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's true of any creative project, right? You've got to set what your boundaries are and use that. Otherwise, you end up with an infinite project that never finishes.
Is that how the deluxe edition came about? Like you said, okay, if I were to go outside the box, this is what would be created? You know, just a little bit better components and including the dice and, you know, having that tuck box to hold it in?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So, because the $1 version... So I made it, I worked so hard, I figured out how to make this work as a $1 game, because the hardest part actually is the markers that I used. Mm-hmm. What I ended up doing was figuring out, I'm like, okay, if you've ever, a lot of the counters used in games are so thin, they're hard to pick up, which I hate. I wanted something that was good to manipulate, right? And was cheap enough to manufacture so it would be in the $1. And I ended up taking a hole puncher to some corrugated cardboard, and I figured out how to create these tiny little discs that were thick enough to manipulate, right? So I was really proud of that. But at the same time, it's discs of corrugated cardboard. I mean, right?
Yeah.
In the modern board gaming sense, we live in the 21st century, right? As I mentioned previously, it's all about the experience. The player wants to engage all their senses and be pleasantly surprised by the game that they're playing, right? It should look good visually. The components should sound good on the table. The components should feel good to the hand. And while I really feel like the corrugated cardboard markers are awesome, right? I really am proud of them. But they're just going to wow somebody, right? And so after I'd gone through all the trouble of trying to get down under $1 and making it work, now I had to deal with the fact that if I'm going to go on Kickstarter, you have to have a deluxe edition, right? And so I set a new goal. I'm going to set the goal to make it a $5 game as a deluxe. And so with that constraint, how far up can I go from where I am? And it started with, finding the right markers. I started with some Euro cubes, and these are fine. They work. But at the same time, right, they're not as nice as I would like. People are at this point almost used to things like meeples, right? The Euro cubes were very popular before meeples came along, but now they're considered more prototyping components and are rarely seen in an actual game, unless you're making ultra-tiny epic kingdoms, right?
Oh, yeah.
when I got down to the $1 components, what had finally cinched the deal for me was being able to print cards from Print and Play, Add Magic's Print and Play, and I was able to do it cheap enough to where, if necessary, I could do a small run just on that alone, right? And looking in their catalog, they had these translucent cubes, which, you know, I ordered some and played with them, and I'm like, these are awesome, right? Right, that they're really nice to look at. You set the board up, and you like, it looks like gems, right? you know, it looks expensive. And then the cubes feel really good, right? The wood of Euro cubes is fine, but the plastic gems, I mean, they just feel nice in the hand.
We come from a generation that is in love with plastic, personally. Our toys were plastic, our games were plastic, our phones are mostly plastic now. So I think it makes a lot of sense that we would view wood as a little less desirable and plastic as the better feeling option there. So I definitely agree that the plastic cubes is the way to go.
Yeah. Yep. No, I totally agree with you. The next problem I had was, but I wanted to make the dice fit the expected size of a padded envelope, for the deluxe edition. And so I had to go 12 millimeter instead of the standard 16 millimeter, right? 16 millimeter is what most people are used to when it comes to dice. The problem when I got done 12 millimeter is I did a few runs with my son and he hated them. He's like, Dad, I can't hit anything. When I roll these 12 millimeter dice, they never come up a 5 or 6. And it wasn't strictly true. Sometimes they came up a 5 or 6, but it did seem off. So I started researching the problem. It turns out that like Chessex dice, most of the dice we see, they have these rounded corners, and we think dice are supposed to be that way. But the problem is that those rounded corners cause the dice to continue rolling, and they do the weirdest thing, right? You would think that the side with the most material would end up down, right? So you'd always get like 6s or 5s, right? It doesn't work that way. Apparently, the momentum is imparted on the greater amount of material. And so the dice keep rolling until the side with the greater amount of material ends up on top. So you get 1s, 2s, right? Instead of the 5s or 6s you would expect. The solution
that explains our awesome dice rolling skills.
The solution is square dice. These ones that I use in Stellar Armada, these are very, very square, right? There's almost no rounding on them. Just enough to take the edges off, not much else, right? So when you roll these really don't go anywhere, right? You shake them, right? And then you land them on the table, and they maybe flip over once, and that's it. These will actually give you real randomization, which the rounded dice will not. So players use these in playtesting. We've never had a problem with these. I like these. These are the types of dice I'm going to try and ship with the game. Again, I sourced these from Ad Magic's Print and Play, I've been working with Ad Magic as one of the manufacturers I've talked to, and you know, they're like, yeah, we can get you those dice. I really like them. I mean, these are really nice dice. They may be 12 millimeter, but they're good looking. They feel good in the hand. They roll nice, and you get good probabilities. What more can you ask for? And then, of course, once I had all that, right, and I was still putting this deluxe edition in a plastic bag, right, I was like, I really got to get a box for this thing. And so I started trying to figure out what I could do around that. Actually found a printing company that could make me 800 to 1,500 boxes. And I got the bright idea at some point of, I think what it was is that I was again going through Ad Magic's stuff, and the cheapest thing I could make was a tuck box. Still wasn't cheap enough for me to use them to print it, but it was the cheapest thing they had. And the cheapest version was this 36-card tuck box. And I'm like, hey, this would be the perfect size. I'm sitting there doing measurements and figuring out. I'm like, well, you know, these dice would be, you know, just the right height, right? There'd be a little bit of clearance above them that would fit really well. And I'm like, okay, components, yeah, they should all fit in there, right? And so I ordered some, and sure enough, it all fit, and it was beautiful.
Love it when a plan comes together. So real quick, one last question. After this, because I'm looking at the Kickstarter page, you've definitely blown away your original, you know, goals, and you're moving on to the next stretch goal. You know, this game looks like it's going to be a success for you. You know, do you see yourself being like, this is going to be your market? You're going to try to stay within these constraints and make more games like this? Or do you have other ideas that you might use to expand, you know, or are you just done? You just wanted to see if you could do it.
So let's see here. I'm not sure yet is the simple answer.
Okay.
So
that's very fair.
What I can tell you is that the, you know, I started down the thinking of, hey, you know, what if I could do multiple ships and what if yada, 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 right? And it was, it easily threatened to become one of those hobbies that never actually becomes a real thing. And a friend of mine kind of pushed me like, okay, you've got something here that is workable that you can take to market, do it. And so that's what I did, right? I focused on making that come to market, and I saw no reason not to. You know, put my business hat on, and as you can see, seem to be doing a lot right. I'm doing there's plenty of things I'm doing wrong that I'll, you know, learn from and not do again. But for the most part, I seem to be doing a lot of things right, and so that's great. But at the same time, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, hey, this system is innovative and would be really cool. And what if I could do the multiple ships type of thing? So kind of this grand plan I would love to execute is, so after this, by the way, I don't know if you guys noticed, a lot of the artifacts for this game, you see what it says right below the Stellar Armada there?
Skirmish.
Right. Mm-hmm. So people aren't even noticing this. I love that. It's meant to be the subtitling of the game should I ever need to subtitle it.
That's a good backdoor there for you.
Right. So if I make a second game, right, well, this one just becomes Stellar Armada Skirmish, and the next one might be like Stellar Armada Fleet Command or something, whatever I end up calling it.
Nice.
And then if that one works, right, if I really like that one, well, what would be neat on top of that is to have some sort of system level or fleet level maneuvering on top of that, where you take large hex tiles. So not hex encounter. That's not what I'm going for. I don't want to bring that back. But large hex tiles that would build out a solar system type of thing. And ships would only engage when they're in the same hex tile. Right. So you do fleet maneuvers and decide how to split your fleets and engage each other. And then what would be cool if that works is to then get into an empire game type of thing where you would build an empire and then, you know, land in the systems and try to fight each other. Yeah. So that, I guess that's really inspired by Starfire, but it's a natural progression. And it would be kind of a neat, I guess, expansion to the previous game, as opposed to, it might not be a completely new game, might just be an expansion type of thing.
So you got a whole, like, world-building aspect going on here. I mean, you know, each game gets bigger and bigger, but it's building off of this tiny little $1 game. That's really cool. Anything else you'd like to, you know, plug or, you know, mention? You know, any new announcements for Stellar Armada?
Oh, I haven't talked about the four-player game at all.
Oh, that's right. Yes, you just announced those rules too.
It was there from the beginning, but the rules weren't the preview of the rules weren't available until today. But yeah, the four player game was something that I kind of conceived of from the beginning of, hey, if I could sell you two copies, then you could play with four players, right? But I couldn't pull together enough people that would make good playtesters to ever test it. A friend told me about a conference known as Protospiel, and went there the weekend before I was launching my Kickstarter, and ran into some designers there doing four players with this. I'm like, well, it's funny you should mention that. And they worked through it with me, you know, initial attempts, there were some problems with it. You know, you can read about it in the update I put out. Then we figured out that if you can only attack the player to your left and right, it changed the dynamics in such a way as to make the four player game really fun. And since the Kickstarter's launch, it's been the most popular pledge level to get the two deluxe so that you can play the four-player game. So with two deluxe, though, right, you have two players with red dice and two players with blue dice, which is fine. Just alternate them or don't, or who cares, right? Everyone's got their own dice. But what I said about it being the experience, right? People want the best experience possible. Well, I've got, you know, two boxes of stuff. I want everyone to have their own stuff, right? So people are now asking for, you know, additional dice colors. So I need to have a conversation with my manufacturer. Hey, what if we did a print run? Because we're trending toward a fairly large print run at this point. What if we did a print run where we had a version of this tuck box with different colored dice in it, and the tuck box would say like Kickstarter exclusive on it. Especially because I'm getting the sense that there's retail interest as well. So, you know, might as well print up a whole batch and send, you know, them to retailers for them to sell at, say, $10 a copy. So with the Kickstarter exclusive, then people could get a standard copy and a Kickstarter exclusive copy, and now they've got four different colors of dice to use during the game. Comes back to that, you know, really quality experience that we want to give people. So those are the types of things I'm thinking about. I think that would, you know, make for some really awesome stretch goals. But we're talking big numbers at this point, right? For a game that funded at $500, you know, we're starting to look at stretch goals. They're up in like the 20,000 range.
You're getting there. Clearly, there's quite a bit of interest on this. I mean, you got 615 backers and 25 days to go. So.
Yeah,
I'd already call this a success.
Exactly. So I'm really pleased about that. I think we're going to do well here, and I'm really excited about getting it in backers' hands. I'm really proud of this game. You know, I set out to make a good game. You know, where I started from with the obligatory pledge level game, right, not being a real game, I wanted to not only make a real game, but a good game that people want to come back to. And I think I've really achieved that. People are really excited about it, and I cannot wait to put it in their hands and have them go, hey, this is interesting. This is cool. This is different. And also, I really am excited for them to experience kind of these new mechanics, right? I didn't set out to develop a new way of doing space combat, but it kind of ended up that way. Hey, there was a review today that compared it to the computer game Faster Than Light, FTL. If you guys ever played that.
I've heard of it.
Which I thought was very interesting. Very interesting comparison. And to get that level of interactivity of ship-to-ship combat in a board game, I think is really cool. So I'm excited. Backers seem to be excited. I can't wait to get it out there.
Cool. We can't wait to see it.
Do you have any cons or anything that you're visiting lately that you want to plug? Let the people know you're going to go and visit.
Into visiting the Protospiel Madison. Don't know if I'll have anything to take with me then, but love to meet up with some of the guys that I previously met up with. And hey, if I've got a few cards to take with me, that would be cool.
Very good.
Nice. All right. Well, thank you very much, Jarrison, and wish you the best of luck with the game. I mean, you clearly already had the success there, but I hope it keeps going for you. And I can't wait to see what else comes out from it.
All right. Thank you very much.
No problem.
That wraps up this episode of Board with Friends. If you have questions to ask, grievances to make, or comments to deliver, follow us on Twitter at Board with Friend, like us on Facebook, or just send us an email at boardwithfriends42@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this show, check out some other great podcasts like Talk Wrestle Talk or the Local Multiplayer Podcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.